and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3538, Representative Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a hearing, House Bill 3538 today. It's a product of many hours in a work group in Northeast Oregon. And I believe you have the Dash 1 amendments bill before you. And I'm anticipating that any bumps that might be seen along the way have been ironed out. And hope that we can move the bill today. Bill Mammon is down from the Grand to testify on the bill. He has been involved extensively in the work group that brought this bill forward and identified the needs of the bill. And with that, I would turn it over to Dale.
Thank you, Representative Simmons, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity of discussing with you and being available this afternoon to discuss the history. I would introduce at this time Tina Kitchen, who has helped me write the bill and make some amendments to it, and I believe it does pass the muster from her department, and she's available also for answering questions. Before I begin, I did fax over yesterday some little history. Has the committee members had the opportunity to review that, or should I go through that very briefly at this time? Go ahead and go through it.
Yeah, very briefly.
Thank you. This proposal arose out of a task force, a self-appointed task force in Union County that rapidly grew into a task force in Eastern Oregon, five or six Eastern Oregon counties, in which we identified an issue that was not being met in rural Oregon. And that is the issue of a public guardianship. A little bit about myself. I was the district attorney for 15 years, involved with many mental commitments. In the last 16 years, I've been in the private practice specializing in elder law issues, having served as a guardian and conservator in many cases and having represented filing of many, many petitions for guardianship out of Umatilla, Union, Baker, Wallowa counties. This task force first explored the prospect and probability of having a public guardian. The Oregon law for many years has provided for a county-designated public guardian, in which the county court or county governing body appoints a person to serve in that capacity. Unfortunately, that void has not been filled in any of the Eastern Oregon counties, and I'm not aware of it having been filled in any of the other rural areas. There are some counties throughout the state that does have a private business of serving as the public guardian. And also, there's some counties where there is a public guardian. Unfortunately, that is not met. That happened in Eastern Oregon. This problem arose in the conflict and confrontation with the, not confrontation in the sense, but communication options with the medical community, which, as we all know, is becoming more and more anxious about liabilities and finding someone to authorize, sign on, if you please, and authorizing appropriate health care. And the resources available, which we are now using as in the guardianship, which is a quite restrictive, quite costly concept and involving individual time. The problem in Eastern Oregon, and I'm sure in many other parts of the state, is finding someone to serve in that capacity. This legislative proposal is one of last resort. If there's a healthcare representative appointed by the individual or designated by the individual, or if there are family members, friends, or someone willing to serve in that capacity, generally this need would not arise. Target population is one that falls between the cracks, where as our citizenry grow older, I'm finding in my practice that there are more and more people that have no one to make health care decisions. Now, this legislation is not intended to, nor will it, allow an abuse of any of the laws currently in place, such as the commitment proceedings and some of the other procedures that are still in place and will continue to be there. I have submitted to you some written comments, and these comments, the one I'm about to reflect now, comes right out of the enabling legislation that the target population is an individual who is incapable as defined by Oregon Revised Statutes 127.505. Makes no changes in that particular designation. Has not appointed a health care representative. Now, this is the piece of legislation that I, about 6 or 7 years ago, the Oregon legislature passed enabling legislation for health care representative, used to be called power of attorney for health care. And third, does not have a guardian or other person with the power to make health care decisions. And that's very critical. There's no one out there. The current process that is used in many occasions is the appointment of a guardian. There's two processes. It's one process, but two designations of a guardian designation. One is an emergency guardianship, which is a 30-day appointment with one 30-day extension. The process for that is the same process and notice and protections and court visitor as a permanent guardianship. And I would add to my written comments that the delay for a guardianship is 1 to 7 days. That reflects my experience. The emergency guardianship process, the regular guardianship, is from 21 to 30 days delay. And as we all appreciate, those are, in many occasions, unacceptable delays where an individual is in need of having a health care decision made promptly. I would observe the cost factor briefly. This testimony comes from my personal experience. The guardianships, many of these, are currently being paid for by Senior and Disabled Services or DOPC or some other governmental agency. Attorney's fees, filing fees, court visitor fee, these are protections where it's an individual appointed by the court that charges for those services. And plus, I asked the Union County Court Administrator to process, if you please, the cost of the court system in processing a guardianship. And they have estimated those costs to be $62. And in your packet is a detail of how that was computed, minutes in setting up a file and opening mail, et cetera, et cetera. So the current system is not cheap. Plus, it is a delay. The proposal, HB 3538, is to authorize the Department of Human Resources to develop administrative rules to implement the formation of an individual support team to make healthcare decisions for that individual. This is the model that is currently being used by the developmentally disabled division, and that happened about one legislative session ago, I believe. Prior to that time, I would get a call from those folks in Union County or in Eastern Oregon. We have one who was in a home there that required surgery. So we would go into the court system, get an emergency guardianship, and life would go on. The surgery would be performed. That system has worked well. I can testify to that. It has cut down on my business, which I appreciate tremendously in that regard. The other fiscal impact from my observations is that it is a reallocation of existing resources. The folks who, from my perspective, who would be making these decisions are currently spending a substantial amount of time communicating with the attorney, communicating with the medical community, gathering data, trying to find a guardian, finding someone to serve in that capacity, all prior to the needy individual getting health care. So as an attorney, as an advocate, as one who has represented these folks and who has filed many, many of these guardianships in the last 15 or 16 years, I urge your support of House Bill 3538 with the amendments. And the amendments that you have before you have done some, I think, good changes. And for I worked with Tina Kitchen, who is on my right, in developing those amendments. And so at this point, I would ask Tina if she has any observations and be available for any questions from the committee. Thank you for your...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I am the physician who's the medical director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services Division. And I oversee the program within the Developmental Disability Services, the Office of DD Services, for appointing health care representatives for people who are incapable of making their own health care decisions, but who need somebody there to stand up for them and help them through the medical system. We do this by administrative rule that was filed in January of 96. We do this in the belief that the people who are closest to people who are incapable are the best people to be making those decisions. A team provides a necessary safeguard in that if you have more than one head looking at any individual decision, it tends to come out with clearer thoughts behind it. And actually, we have had the system in its work for the last 3 years, and we have ended up with medical decisions being made in a timely manner. So if anybody has any questions.
You support the bill with the Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we support the bill with the Dash 1 amendment.
Question of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see what you're trying to do here to try to help this incapable person. I just have one question. It says that the support team may be formed upon the request of the blood relatives that you've listed. But then on the second page, it says that they're only on the team if they desire to serve on the team. Is there any chance that you're taking the major responsibility for this person out of the hands of the relative, putting it in the hands of the government? I mean, obviously the relatives would be, they would be in favor of that, but my feeling is they should still have the main responsibility for that blood relative.
Let me respond to that, and maybe Tina can. If you follow through on page one of the enabling legislation, beginning with line 24 on through the rest of that page, those are at the request, which indicates that the team may be formed. And the adult child of the individual, the parent of the individual, adult sibling, and finally, if there's nobody around, then it's when the team can step in. On the second page, and I'm probably where it can be stopped, same group of people, I think on the second page it says, we don't want the team doing it, we're going to do it, either individually, the person is no longer in need of having someone make those health care decisions, or we go the guardianship route.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm thinking of a person who would say, I don't want to take care of my father, he's too much trouble, I can get the government to do it, I'm just going to get the support team. Could that happen?
That could happen. My perspective.
Mr. Chair, Representative Close. At least within Developmental Disability Services, this, first off, this doesn't have anything to do with fiscal responsibility for the medical services. Healthcare representatives don't do that. Second of which is that at least within people with developmental disabilities, because of institutionalization, a lot of those family ties have been broken. And so frequently there isn't a family member who is knows the individual and is capable of making those sorts of decisions. There frequently is nobody around. And currently, short of guardianship, then there is no way to get a decision maker. And as the medical system has become more and more sophisticated, what we watched were people who were not receiving necessary medical care because the medical system was not willing to proceed without an authorized, legally authorized person to sign on that line.
Other questions? Thank you. Do we have other folks to testify? Anybody in opposition? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Don't wander too far. We need to follow here. I thought I saw you lurking back there, Bob. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Judendeff. I'm director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. And our objections to this bill don't have to do with the sincere desire of the folks involved to try to come up with a solution to the problem they've outlined for you, the way that the bill would try to solve that problem. And I've provided you with some written testimony, but I'll just outline it in this fashion. Normally, if a person may be incapacitated and need a guardian, someone has to file in court, and there has to be a hearing. You've heard all about that. It takes time and it takes money. There's a judge involved. There's a visitor involved. There's reports, potential hearings, and lawyers, and the whole business. Under this bill, with the amendments, any person who is a client of DHR and not with any resources could have their right to make medical decisions moved to another person without any of those procedural protections or any of that cost or any of those attorneys or any of those judges or any of that business. What's the difference between one person and the other person? The only difference is that one person is a DHR client. And so what gives DHR the power to move a person's decision-making rights or take a person's decision-making rights that's different? Again, only that the person is receiving services from the state. And in fact, it is the state that then goes ahead and takes those decision-making powers and exercises them for the person. The problem with that from our perspective is that there are no procedural protections involved. The person is not entitled to notice under this bill. The person isn't entitled to any sort of independent decision maker. All the persons making decisions for them here are the person's doctor and the person's service provider, all involved with the person. No objective party gets to hear the situation, to hear objections, to make decisions. There's no follow-through and oversight. There's no review down the pike in terms of whether the person remains incapacitated or doesn't remain incapacitated. In other words, even though it's cheap, even though it's easy, and even though it's probably going to be done most of the time in good faith and in the best interest of the person, there are none of the basic procedural protections attached to this process that would attach to anybody else in society. And that's why we would have to object to the way that it's been proposed to be done.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, members of the committee. Our response to that, I believe, is that, and I would direct your attention to page 2, line 4 of the proposal, an individual support team shall not be formed for the incapable individual if any of the persons listed on subsection 2 of this section objects to the formation of the team. And you will note that the amendment, dash 1, includes the individual himself or herself. So that is the built-in protection that was added after the original proposal. So we think that it is there, and if there is this objection, then, as I indicated in my first testimony, the guardianship is still an option. All of the due processes are still there.
This is designed to meet all through the cracks in the emergency situation.
Senator Piercy.
What guarantees are in place down the road to deal with the review issue that was brought up, where you might, at some point later, find the person is no longer incapable and needs to be addressed again? The team would look at that, or?
I can respond. I guess my first response to that would be, I think that would be part of the administrative regulations that would be developed by Department of Human Resources or its designee. Finally, this is intended to be an enabling legislation, and with the individual being number one in the formation of the team or the dissolution of the team. So if either of those events occur, and we hopefully will have a responsible person as the spokesperson for the team itself. And if the person comes in and says, I don't want this surgery, if I were a team member, I wouldn't sign. You have
anything to add, Gina?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also see this bill as an enabling legislation to put it through the rule process. Within the rule process, we put in more safeguards than you see in front of you within the statute, one of which is that we only allow the appointment to happen for a year, and therefore the team has to go back through the process every year of determining that the person is incapable. We also require within our rules that there be concurrence, meaning that everybody agrees enough to agree that they don't disagree with both the fact that the person is incapable, who the person should be the spokesperson, and then third, what the major decisions should be. So that's not within the statute, but that's some of the ways we've dealt with it administratively.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Any discussion? We are in work session. Representative Piercy.
I'll move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3538.
Representative Piercy has moved the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion, questions, any objections? Hearing none, the dash ones are adopted. Representative Piercy.
Chair, I will move House Bill 3538 as amended to the floor with the due pass resolution.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion, questions? Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Kinnon.
Aye.
Representative
Kirstie.
Aye.
Representative
Lehman.
Aye.
Representative
Knope.
Aye.
Representative
Folks. Aye. House Bill 3538, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Simmons, do you want to carry? Representative Simmons will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3538. And because we are, thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Because we are still short members, we'll open up work session on House Bill 3408. I don't think. Well,
oh my.
Thank you.
Well, that helped our
Great.
Nice.
They came from the
Grand. Oh,
they
did?
Yes.
Or maybe, I don't know.
This is an important thing for them.
From where?
Wow.
The Grand.
Why is it
really?
Because there's a real need in the real rural parts of the state for this.
So those young people were here for that? Do they work for hospitals or something?
No, they just have, they're just a family and things like that.
Oh.
Do you want to kind of explain this for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm BJ Smith. I'm the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. And I'm pleased to be here today to bring you House Bill 3408. This bill is a bill having to do with community mental health services and how they relate to the Oregon Health Plan. The bill also, I want to just make certain that you have it, draw to your attention, we also do have a dash one amendment that is very small. The company is just a one-word change. It's If you'll notice the sponsors on this bill, primarily they are Clackamas County legislators. And I have several people here, actually. We get a couple of minutes here. We can explain about what happened to Clackamas County last year. But we did have an occurrence where we found two statutes really didn't, were in effect, the Community Mental Health Plan statute and the Oregon Health Plan that provided benefits for mental health were in effect. And we didn't know how to bridge the gap between the two statutes. And as a speaker said earlier, we felt that we fell between the cracks of these two statutes. We really didn't, we had a problem and we didn't have a way to resolve the problem. What 3408 does is try to establish a constructive way to resolve a problem that we think we might fall into that crack in the future, but we also think that many other counties could fall into this crack in the future. And what we're trying to do here is bridge the gap and promote some better communication between what the principles and operation are of the local community mental health programs and the operation of the state when it provides funding through the Oregon Health Plan. This bill only really has two sentences in it that are significant. On the first page, you'll see line 13 through 15. It says that the provision of services under this section of the law shall promote, and that section of the law has to do with the Oregon Health Plan, mental health services, shall promote and be consistent with local community mental health and development disabilities programs that are already established in your county. The particular program in Clackamas County doesn't necessarily look like the county that you have in your district at home. We run ours in a particular fashion, and many other counties run theirs in a different fashion, but we think it's constructive that we try to promote the use of those community mental health programs because they really do tie in with local planning processes for how community mental health and safety net services are provided. The one of the members of our delegation pointed out that the word promote sounded like we should have flags and banners and we should wave signs. And so the amendment changes the word promote to the word support, which I think is just a little more conventionally found in the statute. So that is what this bill has to do with. It has to do with community mental health programs locally, and it has to do with trying to bridge the gap to make certain that when funding is made available for mental health programs, for the Oregon Health Program, that there's an express statement that there should be, that those decisions at the state level should be consistent and supportive of the decisions at the local level. So, simple. What I would say is this bill doesn't seem to do a lot, but as we go on, we have quite a number of people in the room today from all over the state and also our clients and consumers in mental health, and we all believe that these simple words have a great deal of meaning in terms of communication and improving programs, state and local. Mr. Chairman, it's an architecture bill, actually, in mental health. Changes the architecture.
Does anybody oppose this? Are you aware?
As far as I know, Mr. Chairman, I have. We've been involved in the Mental Health Integration Task Force during the summer. We've talked at length with people about trying to do something in this venue. No one has approached me with specific concerns about language except for the word promote, and we were willing to make that change.
We are in work session, so this isn't necessarily public testimony. I know there's lots of folks here. Is your desire to talk or pass the bill, I guess, would be the thing. And unless there's somebody that has a very burning desire, I think we got universal support, and we'd just soon pass the bill. Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, sorry.
I think I would, do we have anyone from the Oregon Health Plan who could speak for it or about it? I think Barney's down.
I don't think anybody else can do any conversations
with... I don't know what effect it would have on the Oregon Health Plan's mental health.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Taylor, I did have some conversations with the department earlier, and it was an exchange of information. As far as I know, they are neutral on this. We discussed a couple of issues related to the bill. We have also had discussions, and we've run a copy of this bill several times past Barney State, who basically served as the chair of the Mental Health Integration Task Force during the summer. He is aware of it. Also, Senator Hannon served on that task force, and he has agreed to co-sponsor this bill because we do think that it's relatively consistent with the discussions of the task force.
This has been on our agenda for a while, and I would have assumed that if Barney had a real problem, I would have heard from him. So I turn to Piercy.
Move those Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3408.
Representative Piercy has moved the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any discussion or questions? Any objections? Hearing none, the Dash 1s are adopted.
Okay, I will move House Bill 3408 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Crumlin.
Aye.
Representative
Knoll.
Aye.
Representative
Close. Aye. Chair Cruz. Aye. House Bill 3408, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Crumlin, will you carry?
I would be honored to.
The chief sponsor, you better be honored.
thank you.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on, or work session, excuse me, House Bill 3408. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, at the risk of losing the bill, may I thank members of the committee.
We do, rather than get totally sideways. Okay, committee, last week we sent two very, very fine bills to Ways and Means that we shouldn't have sent to Ways and Means, simply because there was a lot of money attached, kind of, sort of, but we found out after the fact that those budgets have already passed. So they have nothing to do with them in Ways and Means. So they are back with us today for possible reconsideration. And what we will do is I will move to suspend the rules. To allow reconsideration of House Bill 2240. Is there any objections? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. Do you want to make that motion on that one?
Make this motion?
Yeah, move to reconsider.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to reconsider the vote with a recommendation and subsequent referral to Ways and Means for House Bill 2240.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion passes. Now, was that an amended bill?
This one was not amended.
Chair, I will move House Bill 2240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Yes. Aye.
Representative Crummel.
Aye.
Representative Snow.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Chair
Cruz. Aye. House Bill 2240, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Piercy will carry.
Thank you.
Close the work session on 2240. And move to suspend the rules to allow the reconsideration of House Bill 2241. Any objection? Hearing none, the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair, I would move to reconsider the vote with recommendation for subsequent referral to Ways and Means for House Bill 2241.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any objection? Hearing none, the motion carries. This was amended.
Okay. I will move House Bill 2241 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Crumlin.
Aye.
Aye.
I'm going to go no on this one because of the amendments.
Aye. House Bill 2241, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Pat Tridge will carry. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2241.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, it's nice when you can fix your mess ups, isn't it?
He didn't say.
Yeah, might as well. You're going to open a work session on House Bill 3264?
Personal. Point of order. Mr. Chair, you didn't name a carrier, I believe.
On the last
Patridge.
One?
On the last one?
Representative Patridge. Will
oh, Patridge, okay. Thank you.
Come on out, John.
Evidently, that was paying attention.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, I'm Jim Seagraves from Oregon City. I'm very pleased that Representative Knoop introduced this bill, 3264. It's a bill that Representative Patty Milne and I submitted 2 years ago. It was more or less replaced by 2207 2 years ago, which established the FEOP program. Reading part of my handout, 3264 requires the DHR to apply for a federal waiver to combine the Medicaid demonstration program and the Family Health Insurance Program Assistance Program, FEOP, into one Medicaid program using means-tested vouchers and giving the recipients more choice than they now have. Implementing the provisions of this bill will allow people to design their own health insurance and retain that coverage no matter how much their income or their assets fluctuate. Skipping down to point four, HB 3264 allows responsible persons with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level to choose a high deductible MSA policy, medical savings account policy. Those permitted to do so would have to deposit in their MSA each year 65% of the deductible. That's for individuals, 75% for family policies. If any Medicaid money goes into an MSA, that money can only be used for medical purposes. Table 1 of the comparison, the next two pages, provides a comparison of the net costs of preferred provider policies now being offered in Oregon by Fortis Insurance Company. This causes me to think that the medical savings account policies could reduce medical expenditures of the voucher recipients by 30% to 50%. I wonder if there are any questions about the cost comparison that I prepared on pages 2 and 3. Page 3, for example, shows that if your expenses which apply to the deductible were, say, $1,000 a year, under the PPO policy, your net cost after tax deductions would be $1,810. With the MSA policy, it'd be $600 less, $1,292. This this table illustrates what would happen in a year of unusually high medical expenses. Going back to the first page, House Bill 3264 moves away from a welfare plantation model that treats all low-income people alike. Many of these people are ambitious and frugal and want to take care of themselves. Over a 15-year period in our country, many more people move from the lowest to the highest income bracket than stay in the lowest. That's substantiated by a Michigan State study. Table 2 compares the current levels of health subsidies with those from a straight line sliding scale that connects from 50% of the federal poverty level to 200% of the federal poverty level. If you ask the Legislative Revenue Committee to estimate the net savings to the state budget, you may also want to ask them to consider a more generous set of subsidies. So page 4 of the handout illustrates a more generous set of subsidies for the vouchers, somewhat similar to the subsidies that are available under the Medicaid demonstration program. Those are the first three lines, and the FEOP program, the second three lines. Are there any questions about the level of support?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Cromwell.
I'd like to just clarify one thing, and that is, an eligible person at less than 200, if their income is less than 200% of the federal poverty level, a federal poverty level is on an annualized basis, what, right around $12,000? Is that correct?
For a family of four, it would be closer to $16,000. For an individual, it would be about $8,000.
Okay, so $16,000. See if I can do the math. So if 200% of that would be around $48,000 on an annualized basis. Is that correct?
What would 200? Four would be about $32,000.
Oh, 200%, 300 would be $32,000. So anybody that makes less than $32,000 would be eligible for the voucher program.
And the voucher could only be used to help them buy health insurance.
And the funding for the voucher is going to come from?
So at the level of support indicated on page 4, the state would have the money coming from the state and federal government, and the implications for the state budget would be a reduction. If you look at page 4,
page 4 of your testimony, sir?
Of my handout.
Thank you.
Under the current program, from 0 to 50% of the poverty level, I'm assuming the current program provides 100% of the expected cost of Medicaid, right?
I see.
And the other proposals would do the same, right, for the people from 0 to 50. At the 75% of the poverty level, the support under the bill as it was proposed would be 83.3%.
I see.
For the 175% of the poverty level, the support would be at 16.6%. But two-thirds of that would come, 62% of that would come from Medicaid, from federal support, federal matching grants. The actual state funding would be reduced.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Are there any, is there anyone else who wants to speak on this bill? Here today? Wait for the chair to come back before we make any movement on it.
Are we at ease?
I think we're at ease for 2 minutes.
You got the capital moment.
Yeah, just move this thing out.